My first experience. My first experience was far more of a test than anything that has ever happened to me since in that line. Not more agreeable, but certainly more testing. I have noticed several times that it is to beginners that strange things happen, and often, I think, to beginners only. When you know about a thing, there is just nothing to it. This kind of thing included, anyway, in most cases. After the first six women, say, or seven or eight, the rest come much of a muchness. I was a beginner, all right, raw as a spring onion. What's more, I was a real mother's boy, scared stiff of life and crass ignorant. Not that I want to sound disrespectful to my old mother, she's as good as they come, and I still hit it off better with her than with most other females.
We're about to get our audience whiplash.
We're going to give our audience the worst cultural whiplash they've ever had, because yep. what's been going on?
So we tried to watch our movie.
Uh-huh.
We tried real hard to watch our movie.
We tried so hard to watch our movie.
Yeah. We actually got into the movie again.
Mm-hmm. Twice.
Yeah. We got like 15, 20 minutes in.
Yes. And?
It didn't work.
It didn't work.
Anymore.
So we were supposed to cover Defending Your Life. And don't
worry.
Which
we want to watch.
We desperately want to watch it. We have seen the first chunk, like little tiny chunk of Defending Your Life a couple of times now, and love it so far.
Yes.
It's an amusing movie. It's fun. It's funny. Albert Brooks is charming.
Mm-hmm.
But unfortunately, we keep trying to watch it, and technical difficulties keep arising. We will get to it, but I, you know what I said? I said, hey, you want to descend into the darkness again?
Let's do it.
Because you brought up at Christmas,
Christmas. Crimbo, yes.
We were hanging out for Crimbo, and you said, Dad, we haven't gotten to Medusa in the Shield yet.
Yeah.
Right, because we finished the first chunk of The Dark Descent. We finished mm-hmm. The Color of Evil, right?
Yeah. That's what it's called, right?
The first book
in
the book. And you were like, we haven't done the second chunk, which is called Medusa in the Shield. And I don't believe when we did The Dark Descent before, we really talked about the difference between the three sections. I think we kind of just skated over that and jumped right into the story.
Yep.
The first section, The Color of Evil, was about he talks about this in the intro, David Hartwell does.
Mm-hmm.
He says that the three principal modes or clusters are 1, moral allegorical, 2, psychological metaphor, and 3, fantastic. So the first chunk was about the moral allegorical, which was mostly about the battle of good and evil.
Yeah.
And moral horror, which we saw in
The Autopsy.
The Autopsy. We saw it in The Whimper of Wimped Dogs.
We saw it in Vandy Vandy.
Vandy Vandy, yep. We
gotta
are...
get that prime George Washington dollar to kick the ass of a wizard.
You've got to bring George Washington to life by casting a spell on a silver dollar.
Was it a silver dollar or a quarter?
It doesn't matter.
A nickel?
The ghoul man was afraid of King Washington.
Yep.
Old King Washington. That was a weird story.
That was an awesome story.
I read that out loud to Mitzi. She was bemused.
Yes.
The second group, though, is the one we're on now. Starting on now, mm-hmm. the psychological metaphor. Hold on. I'm going to let the cat out of the room. The cat loves being in and out of the room now because I'm the only room in the house that has a window open because I'm in your old bedroom, which is, say it with me,
a nightmare.
Hot as hell.
It is hot as hell. You see what I was complaining about so much when I was...
So when it's literally 14 below zero outside, I have this window open and it makes things nice and cool. But the cats love it now. They want to come in and out. In any case, we're on the psychological metaphor, which he says are stories of aberrant human psychology embodied metaphorically. It may be either purely supernatural, such as Dracula, or purely psychological, such as Robert Bloch's Psycho. But what characterizes them as a group is the monster at the center, from the monster of Frankenstein to Carmilla to the chainsaw murderer, an overtly abnormal human or creature from whose acts and on account of whose being the horror arises. Ta-da.
Ta-da.
Ta-da. So we're dealing with psychological horror here, or as our author that we're covering today refers to it, strange stories.
Hey, you know, I love that.
strange stories. He always bristled. I've read so many things about him now, and they always use the term bristled. He bristled at being called a horror writer because he preferred strange stories.
I wouldn't call this horror, to be honest.
I would a lot, actually. This story really distressed me and disturbed me.
It was distressing and disturbing.
And I found it horrific, mostly for the implications. But this is our second Robert Aikman story. Oh, yeah, we're discussing Robert Aikman.
Yep, welcome back, guys, by the way.
To the dark descent.
You have no choice. This is what we're doing now.
The man of aches, the man of many aches, Bobby the Ache Man. He felt it in his bones. He ate bone-hurting juice, and now he's an aching man.
And he became larger than oneself.
And we covered larger than oneself. Do you remember how weird that story was?
I don't even remember that story.
That was the story of the woman who gets invited to a party to which she's not invited.
Oh, that's
It's mostly
right.
People discussing their, like, weird religious beliefs. And then in the end, a giant light appears in the sky. Everyone dissolves except for a few people. They get merged into the sky. And everyone's just like, what happened?
Right. That was the story that was all about social anxiety.
It was about social anxiety. Yep.
Yeah.
But we really liked it. And I only found out later that that's a weird one to start with Robert Aikman.
One to start with anything.
Well, the story we're reading now, I guess, is more what people think of when they think of, like, what most people begin with. Because it's also the first story of, like, his most popular collection, Cold Hand in Mine. And people are like, yeah, that's generally what people think of when they think of, like, beginning Aikman is, like, this.
Sexual assault.
It's weird because outside of just the fact that it's strange fiction, Aikman is known very much for creating a distressing mood, presenting weird things happening and never explaining them, but never making the metaphor too overt either. I think the metaphor in this is actually more overt than he usually does. Mm-hmm. It's a pretty self-explanatory. This book is about, like, the story is about, to one degree or another, like, the man's attitudes towards sex as a young man and, like, the violence we casually inflict upon women.
Mm-hmm.
Also, expectations of sex. It's very much about sex. This book is found in, like, several collections of, like, sexy horror stories.
This is not a sexy horror story.
But it's not sexy. In fact, it's the opposite of sexy.
It is the Matt Smith of sexy short stories.
Oh, my God.
I had to bring that joke back. Come on.
Did you just compare the poor boy Matt Smith? He's just a poor boy. Nobody loves him. He's just a poor boy from a poor family.
That was the Joker or Morbius episode.
Oh, I consider Matt Smith the least sexy actor alive.
I love him.
Oh,
I want that to be made clear.
I enjoy watching a Matt Smith performance. I do not consider him a sexy man.
I love him.
I consider... I'm trying to think. Paul Giamatti sexier than I consider.
I don't even know who that is.
No offense to Paul Giamatti, who's a wonderfully lovely man. But just when I watch Paul Giamatti on screen, I'm like, that's a sexy performance, more than when I watch Matt Smith on screen, where I'm like, that's an absurd puppet man.
Of, like, what's going on when House of the Dragon first started coming out and people started making thirst posts about his character. I was like, excuse me?
I just don't understand. I mean, again, I love Matt Smith. I think he's a talented man.
I want to meet Matt Smith, and I want to give him a hug because I love him.
I feel like if you gave him a hug, you'd find out he was made of licorice. Like, and I don't know why. Like, he doesn't seem like he's made of human parts. He's made of, like, well, maybe he's made of whatever's going on with the woman in our short story, because we're covering Robert Aikman's The Swords. And yes, it's got swords in it. A whole pile of them.
It does have swords.
Mm-hmm. And these swords do poke, and they do stab, and nobody gets hurt because of them. They do fall apart eventually, though. The people, mm-hmm. not the swords. Just fall right apart. Just hands come off.
Was anyone together in this at the beginning of this anyways?
Was anyone together?
Yeah.
Like, body part wise?
Just in general.
Robert Aikman had a weird relationship with women.
I can tell.
He was married. He also had a mistress. The mistress and the wife, I guess, got along. They helped each other with their literary careers, it sounds like. But his parents were not happy together, and they, from what I've read, they split up early, and they tried to find in their son a boon companion, as opposed to finding another. So they treated their son like a buddy, a pal, and it caused a lot of problems with him, because he was like, I just need my parents to love me as a child. And so he kind of sought that for the rest of his life, like sort of this love and acceptance from what people have said. And he's been written about, like his, you know, he was friends with people, like big literary people. People have written about Aikman. He died in 81. But he seems like a nice enough guy. He was for being a relatively well-off British man born in the beginnings of the 20th century. As we said in the last episode, he had his prejudices and his faults. But it seemed like a decent enough guy. But he had issues with women. He was not like a scumbag or anything, but like he just, you could tell from his writing that when the woman wasn't the protagonist, and his female protagonists are pretty much people like, yeah, they're well-written characters. When his female non-protagonists are objects of sexual desire, there's usually something weird going on.
Yep.
Which I guess makes sense from a writer of strange fiction.
Of strange, sexy fiction.
Do you think
he would appreciate his story being considered sexy horror?
Yes, because I think he was trying to unsettle you with the sex in his horror. And I guess he put more sex than most into his books because people have noted that. They're like, like a lot of horror just shies away from sex. But his sex is actually like about...
Yeah.
Sex, not just like there for like...
His sex is about sex?
Well, it's not just there to like for prurient interest.
Yeah, yeah.
It's there because it's important to the story. It's what it's about. He's commenting on sex.
And how weird it is.
And oh boy, is it weird in this short story, because this is about... It sets itself up right off the top with the fact the narrator is like, this is a story about my first time having sex. Mm-hmm. Comes right out and says it. It's not good.
No.
It's not good. How it all comes about. This is the grimiest story I think we've read.
Okay. This we've got we went through what was the book we read called?
Frankenstein.
No, the other book.
Nightmare Alley.
We went through Nightmare Alley, and that describes some grimy fairgrounds.
That's a grimy story.
This is grimier.
And it's grimier quick. This is not a long story.
Yeah, this is what, like 20-something pages?
Yeah, you can just get through this in a quick sitting.
Mm-hmm. I did right before we started recording.
It makes me feel filthy having read this. Not like morally filthy, but like I wandered. I used to visit my dad's work sometimes. He worked at the post office. He was a manager, health and safety manager. So he had an office and stuff. But when you're a health and safety manager at a post office, your office is like up corrugated stairs. And you spend a lot of time on factory floors. Every once in a while, I would visit him there. And I would walk through the post office, like sorting warehouse in downtown Houston. And I would feel like I just needed a bath afterwards. Because it's just a lot of grease and stale air, and for a child to feel like they need a bath is like a big deal. That's how I felt. I felt like I just sort of like been in a stuffy warehouse for a long time after reading this story, and I just wanted to wash my hands. Also, I felt like I'd been like sitting at a party with someone who I didn't like for a while.
Yeah, this narrator is a narrator. Like, I don't know. You've rubbed me the wrong way.
Mm-hmm. Because he doesn't seem terribly put off in retrospect. I guess the story is like he's telling you this story of something that happened to him when he was a young man. Mm-hmm. So it's a bit of a flashback. So he has some distance from it. But he's not like, I was mortally damaged by what happened to me. No, he's just like, and then this happened. And then the guy said he'd see me again one day, but I never ran into him again. And then what a weird story, kids. And I'm like,
excuse me?
Excuse me? So... He's unnamed, isn't he?
We learn everyone else's name in this book. Is his name at the top of the page? Or at the top of the story?
Nope, that's a quote from Federico Garcia Lorca.
Cool. What is the quote?
Corazón mal herido por cinco espadas.
Wonder what it means.
I know what it means because I looked it up. Would you like to know what it means?
I would like to know what it means.
What it means is... It's in Spanish because it's Lorca.
Yep.
It means corazón mal herido, means wounded heart. Mm-hmm. Por cinco espadas, by five swords.
Okay.
Wounded heart by five swords, or a heart wounded by five swords, something like that. But yeah, I believe that he goes unnamed. But we hear he has an uncle, Elias, who's a big player in this, but he's never there.
In the grocer universe?
In the grocery, the traveling grocery salesman, I guess.
Who? There's apparently a whole fleet of them.
Yep. So this story is set early 20th century. He gets a job. He's a young man. He gets a job with his uncle, traveling the country as a salesperson.
After his father dies in an accident of some kind.
Yeah.
I could not tell when this story was set until they said telly, by the way. When does this take place?
But it's also a British tale, aye?
Yeah.
A little British, because he says the telly, and it also takes place in England.
Yes.
Set in Wolverhampton.
Which is an awesome name.
But which I'm sure the British pronounce something like Wampton. Like, it's one of those words that I'm like, I bet it's, like, really long, but, like, they're like, you don't say all the syllables, you say Wampton, or Wampum, or Wanton, or something. Like, and you're like, oh, I'm sorry, I want from here.
Yeah, like that other, that meme word.
What it's is not it? Pronounced Greenwich, it's Greenwich! I guess. We've got places like that, too. But no one can believe that Minnehaha is actually pronounced Minnehaha around
here. I know, right? That's like...
Minnehaha.
Yeah, it's just Minnehaha. I don't understand what the big... Whatever. Anyways.
It means waterfall.
Yeah.
Laughing waters. Some people just haven't read their Longfellow.
Some people just suck.
Song of Hiawatha.
But that's besides the point.
Song of Hiawatha sucks as well. It's about Native Americans, but like it's based on a guy who took all their tales and like twisted them to his own ends. And then Longfellow was like, no, it's based on the source material. And they're like, no, the source material's very wrong and racist. I read a review, New York Times review of when the Song of Hiawatha came out in like 1856 or whatever. Just yesterday I read it. And because it was like, I believe yesterday was the anniversary of its publication. The Times were like, complete trash. And the reason I thought it was complete trash is they're like, basically, they were like, Native Americans are unworthy. They are rightfully exterminated people whose tales are gross and garbage.
Jeez.
And it's best that we forget all about them. They are not the Greeks. How dare Longfellow attempt to write in like an epic tale of these completely trash people. They're trash. Their stories are trash. It's a good thing we're rid of them. Goodbye. And it's long. It's this long article. It's pretty much all that. Like, spends like the first chunk just being like, Greek epics are awesome. What's Longfellow doing? It's trash.
Man.
New York Times. Trash.
Oh, Jesus Christ. Anyways,
like,
back to the swords.
Horrifying. Yes, back to the swords. So our boy is a traveling salesman. He has to stay at all these flop houses that his uncle loves. I assume they're like brothels. They don't really come out and say it, but I assume that's why his uncle likes to stay at these places. They're gross. Like,
they are gross.
They're dumps.
They're like that, what's the place, what's the rats in the graveyard rats. They're like the place that guy was staying in.
An open grave.
No, you remember the place where he was staying?
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, they're just these like gross flop houses. And I guess he gets a kickback or something for staying in them. We never really figure out why Uncle Elias is mentioned a lot. He's not a character. He is not a player in this.
No, he has asthma.
We learn a lot about this guy. A lot. I just knocked my headphones on the floor. My other headphones, not these. So our boy, our hero, ends up wandering around. He finds a fun fair that is like gross.
Yep. Except the kids playing.
He finds a merry-go-round. Okay, so he's in Wolverhampton. He finds a merry-go-round.
Or a roundabout.
That's like nice.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a nice merry-go-round. I thought this was going to be a big part of the story because he spends a lot of time like describing it.
And the woman who's running it.
The woman who's running it, who's beautiful, seems really kind. But then that's it. Like, we learn a lot about this roundabout. Then he's like, whatever. Which I assume is like if you're wandering through like the fair and like there's like the kiddie roller coaster and you're like, I'm not going to go on that. That'd be weird.
I actually liked that section because up until like that section, it felt very like relatable. He was like, I wasn't going to like be a person and go up to this person and ride the thing by myself. That's weird, and I don't want to be weird. I don't want to look weird. That mm-hmm. that I was like, social anxiety, I get that. The rest of the story,
well, he's got a lot of anxiety.
Yeah.
Because he goes into a tent labeled The Swords. And it's
he doesn't even go in there because he wants to.
He goes in there because he gets, like, he's embarrassed there, not to.
Yeah, because he's like, oh, if I don't go in here, I've just been wandering around this fair for no reason, and everyone's going to be weirded out by me.
Yeah, he walks up to the tent, and the guy who's taking the people's money is just like, two bob. And he's like, well, I can't, like, walk away now. Like,
just
that
walk
would
away.
Be, yeah, that. But it's that anxiety thing. That you know what that's like. We're just like, I gotta... Like, if a person's, like, trying to hand you something on the street, like a flyer or something, and you're like, I don't want this, but it would be far more awkward to not take it, so I'll just take it.
I've gotten used to not taking things, because sometimes on my campus, when I'm walking to class, there'll be people handing out Bibles.
Whole Bibles?
Like, the pocket ones.
Oh, man, I would have so many Bibles right now.
And they're always like, here, do you want a Bible? And I have to be like, no, please, I'm not religious.
What happens is you take them, and then they try to get a donation from you.
Actually, I don't think they're allowed to do that on campus. I think you take them and they try and get you to come to church.
Yeah.
Because I go to a Lutheran school.
You go, now it's my bowl. Yoink. You run off
yoink.
With it.
I should just do this when they hand it to me. Yoink. And then run away.
Yep. I once was like, I lost my copy of the Book of Mormon because I had a copy of the Book of Mormon. I was like, well, I need a Book of Mormon. People were like, dude, just contact the Mormon church, they give those to you for free. And I was like, hot dog. And so I contacted them. I was like, hey, I need a copy of the Book of Mormon. I misplaced mine. And they're like, we'll send you one right away. It's like, aces. Well, what you don't know is that they're also going to send people.
Yep.
And I was like, and they were like, so when would you like to, you know, have a chat? And I was like, how about 9:30 never? And I just sent them away and I kept my copy. And then I found my copy, so I kind of felt bad. But, yeah, it was given to me by an ex-girlfriend.
Why do you need a copy of the Book of Mormon?
I needed to look something up. I was curious about something, and I needed a copy. And this is, like, pre-internet, so I couldn't just hop online.
I'm going to call the Mormon church and ask for a copy of the Book of Mormon now.
Send them to here.
Yeah.
Send them to me. My dad really needs another copy of the Book of Mormon.
Send the exact same people as last time.
It's weird. There's an invisibility cloak in it, and that is... That's a trippy cool. part. There's like all these, it's weird. In any case, we're not talking about the Book of Mormon. Not today.
Not today.
So he goes into this, he goes through the dirty flap. It says dirty flap a few times. Which
it does.
Maybe chuckle. And what is this show? What is this wonderful family entertainment that he goes to see?
Well, there's exactly 7 other people in there aside from him.
Awkward, because there's like 30 chairs.
Yep. There's a man standing on stage, a very strong-looking man. He's explaining what's going, or he's saying something to the people when he walks in. There's a pile of swords, and there's a woman dressed as a witch. Apparently, I don't know. They kept saying green makeup, and I assume they meant like tint.
I guess. Yeah, he kept saying she had green makeup on, like green face paint or green, like
assume like it was like cheap like stage makeup that makes your skin look kind of green.
I guess, because he talks about it a lot.
Yeah, because he said it made her look, like, sickly, which, if it was just green face paint, I don't think that would make any sense.
Yeah, and he only describes the guy as the seaman. He keeps calling him the seaman. He's wearing a seaman sweater.
He's just wearing a blue sweater.
And enough people have commented on it when they're like, is that, like, a double entendre? Like, he keeps referring, like, is it supposed to make you think, there's a lot of spoilers coming up, there's a lot of thrusting into women coming up and talk of semen. I'm just saying.
It's a gross story.
It's weird. So the stack of swords is also like they're laid out like it's not just a jumbled pile. Mm-hmm. And he makes a big deal that the swords look cheap. Like they bought them from like a costume shop or something. Like they're not fancy swords. They look mass produced, which is a weird thing to notice. But he notices a lot of weird things.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what happens? Just what happens in this show?
The guy starts calling for volunteers. Nobody volunteers because no one knows what the heck is going on. And he gets really upset about it until someone finally volunteers. And they pick up a sword and they stab the woman with it. And then they kiss the woman. And the woman's really happy about it.
That's the show. Thanks for coming, folks. Yeah, everyone gets to go up and stab the woman with a sword and then give her as big a kiss as they want. Mm-hmm. And what happens after she's stabbed?
She seems to come more to life.
There's no wounds on her.
There's no blood. Yeah. There's nothing.
And yeah. And she like, because when they first see her, she's like draped across, like she's barely conscious.
Mm-hmm.
And the more they stab her, the more she wakes up and gets like,
yeah.
And our buddy, our pal, is sitting in the back and he's like, again, relatable. He's like, they're going to call on me eventually.
Yep. I got to get out of here. Yep.
It's a thing where you're like, oh, I didn't know this was audience participation. Yeah. Remember all the shows we used to go see together? Mm-hmm. Theater company that I used to work with a lot. Charming people, delightful people. But man, did they love their audience participation.
Yep.
What was your favorite audience participation?
I don't really remember very many of them because I was so young.
But were you there when we saw The Mystery of Edwin Drood?
Yeah.
And
yeah.
That was the guy with the sandwich.
Yes. Yes, I remember that. I think that was probably my favorite.
So Mystery of Edwin Drood, if you're not familiar, is a musical in which the premise is that you're seeing a theater company put on a production about The Mystery of Edwin Drood. So every actor plays an actor playing the characters.
Mm-hmm.
And before the show, the way it's written is they're supposed to kind of be milling around the theater, talking in character, which for some reason seems to translate simply as harass the audience.
Yes.
Like, that's audience participation, is just harass people sitting there. But if you're not fully comfortable doing it, what it usually comes out to is an actor walking up to you and just being like, hey, what have you got there, mate? Hey? And you're like, oh, God, I have to. And but this guy brought in a sandwich.
Thank God this guy was funny.
This guy brought in a Subway sandwich.
Yeah.
Yeah, like a sub. He wasn't eating it.
No.
But what did the people do?
They made fun of him.
But, like, not cleverly.
No, but he responded well, which was good.
Right. So they were like, look, looks like you got a sandwich there. And he's like, yep. And they wouldn't let it go. So, yeah, so he responded,
mm-hmm.
and they didn't know how to deal with that. Like, yeah. they weren't expecting him to play along.
Yeah.
And then I did that as well. One of them came up to me and I was like, oh, wonderful to see you. And they were like, oh, no, like, this isn't supposed to happen. I hate audience participation. So this is audience participation. He was like, I'm out. And he ducks out, runs away. But he runs into the guy who, the
yeah, because he doesn't sleep for the rest of the night, and he doesn't eat or drink anything.
Which you wouldn't either.
No, I would call the police.
Why, though? She seems fine. Clearly, it's some kind of trick. Like, that's what I would think. I've seen a sideshow. I've been to Coney Island. I saw the sideshow performers. People can do all kinds of weird things with their bodies. I would assume that I had seen some kind of illusion.
I wouldn't lose sleep or food or drink over it, though. Might actually, because I think being a woman in this weird world that he's created must suck.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's called The World.
Yeah. Well, yeah.
Like, if I had been to go see a show, and what was disturbing to me wasn't the fact that she was being stabbed repeatedly. What was disturbing to me was the fact that they got to kiss her.
That was weird.
That's the weird part to me, is like, that's usually not how this show kind of... If they had just gotten to go up there and stab her, like, that's weird and, like, kind of icky, because there's, like, a lot of, like, clearly a lot of, like, sexual connotations there. I mean, for everyone who's saying that, like, the Friday the 13th movies are all about sex because the knife is penetration, you know, however true that may be, this is explicitly that. Like, it's a woman who is basically having group sex in front of an audience, but it's with a sword. And she seems to enjoy it. But also you get to kiss her, which is icky.
Yes.
He can't sleep. He can't eat. He runs into the woman and the guy, though, at a restaurant. Mm-hmm. And they're like, hey, come and sit down with us.
And he's like, I was too awkward to say no. And I'm like, yep, okay.
Orders himself a pot pie and a tea.
And he puts the pie in his pocket for later.
And the guy is like, the sailor, the seaman,
mm-hmm.
is like, you want, I noticed you didn't, you know, get up there and participate. And he's like, yeah, it wasn't really my bag, man. He's like, that's cool. If you pay me £10, though, you can have a private showing, just you at your place. She'll do whatever you want her to.
Her name is Madonna, by the way. Or her name isn't Madonna, but that's her stage name.
They call her Madonna. This is pre-Madonna. Not, okay, this isn't pre-Madonna. This is pre-hyphen Madonna.
Yeah.
So at this point, Madonna just means the Madonna.
Yep.
Which they talk about a little bit.
This segment of the story made me really uncomfortable.
Oh, really? How come?
Yeah. Because he was selling her and she did not seem thrilled about it.
To be fair, she doesn't seem thrilled about much. Except no. being stabbed by a bunch of swords.
Yeah. But this just felt icky.
Yeah. He keeps saying that like she's very flat. Like she's not scared or depressed or anything. She's just affectless. Just like, all right, just okay. Like just going along with it. Mm-hmm. And again, there's nothing wrong with sex work. Like if that's your thing yeah. and that's your deal and you're a sex worker, have at it. If no one's forcing you into it, go for it. But yeah, there's something eerie about it. Maybe it's just the overenthusiasm of the guy.
Yeah. And just, I don't know. There's something about him, about the way that he describes Madonna, like the line, she flashed another of her indescribably sweet glances. I don't like it.
Yeah. Now, keep in mind, this guy is, as stated, he's a virgin, mm-hmm. bit of a mama's boy. He calls himself that.
Yeah.
He's completely naive and inexperienced in the world. Mm-hmm. And what this is giving me a lot is that sort of incel thing that mm-hmm. everything I see and everything I witness that has to do with women who I am attracted to is couched in this like sort of creepy, unknowable air. Like my perception is that the world is a lot more mysterious and sexual than it actually is.
Yeah.
So a person with no sexual experience who's already like got a weird attitude towards women, when confronted by a pimp and a sex worker, is now entering into this like phantasmagoria of like trying to read everything on her face and like, what's wrong with this woman? Like, that's what I'm getting from this.
Yeah.
An inexperienced guy who went to see a sex show and thinks it means a lot more than it does.
Yeah.
Like, and then you talk to them later and you're like, my brother in Christ, you just saw something that many people have seen. You saw a sex show and maybe a woman who's not doing well. Like, mm-hmm. she seems sickly, like a little sickly when she hasn't been stabbed with a repeated swords. Because every time he sees her later on, she's like wearing like oversized clothes mm-hmm. and just kind of seems to be swimming in her, like, they're not even not her clothes, like something.
I don't understand how he's not like, this woman needs help.
I understand it because this guy thinks he's going to have sex.
Oh, well, yeah, I guess that makes sense.
He's like, I guess she's a sex worker, and I guess she's coming to my place, and we're going to have sex, and I'm going to have sex for the first time, and I'm going to be happy about it. This is going to be the most amazing thing in the world. That's his attitude.
What a dumb attitude.
She shows up. She's like, I'll do whatever you want.
Well, first, there's an even creepier part.
What's the creepier part?
When he gets the money from that one guy.
Right, because he doesn't have a lot of cash on him.
Yeah, Mr. Edis.
Mm-hmm. How does he get the money from Mr. Edis?
Mr. Edis likes him, I guess, and asks, like, what he's, like, been doing. And he says he has a date, and Mr. Edis says, oh, do you have enough money to get what you want from her, I guess? I don't... Whatever. Let me see. He says, so that you can cuddle her as you want. First of all, Mr. Edis, what the hell? Uh-huh. Second of all, Mr. Edis, what the hell? And he says, no, I don't. And so Mr. Edis gives him $5 and is like, this is yours if you tell me everything that happens after it happens. And I'm like, Mr. Edis, no.
Yeah. Oh, Mr. Edis. This isn't how it's supposed to go. Not like this.
It seems like Madonna is known around town. They call her the Wolverhampton girl.
Yeah. So, again, Robert Aichman's story, we don't get a lot of explanation. This is a mm-hmm. fun fair. Mostly has kids on the ground. And the sideshow, the swords, is not doing too well.
Yeah.
That's what the guy says. He just keeps saying, like, you know, like, haven't had a lot of people. That's why he says he's offering her up to him. Because he can make more money in this by pimping her out than he can, you know. He's like, mm-hmm. we'll do the show. She'll come by your place afterwards. And yeah, so he talks to this customer of his who's like, I like you. I like you better than your uncle.
Because your uncle had asthma and you don't.
Because your uncle had asthma. He's all the time asthmaing, wheezing. I like you. You're young. Just tell me, give me all the gross details when you're done having your first sexual encounter, my boy. Here's $5.
Oh, yeah. His uncle has died at this point, by the way.
Oh, yeah. I forgot about that.
Also, There is a segment at the beginning of this book where he says, where he's talking about the men bringing in women, and then he goes, and sometimes the men would bring in boys, and it just sort of glances over that.
Right. Right. Yeah. That's it.
I'm just going to assume fully consenting gay men, and it's fine.
Fully consenting gay men.
Nothing weird going on there.
Madonna shows up at his place. Fortunately, it's a raining. Flop. Yeah, it's a flop house and nobody cares. Yeah, he goes out to meet her. But nobody cares. It's a flop house. Like, he just brings her up to his room, which he keeps dark because he's embarrassed by it. She's mm-hmm. soaking wet, hangs up her clothes, gets, you know, it described, like, he asks her to undress. He's not, like, mean or weird or anything. Mm-hmm. He's obviously an awkward guy. He doesn't know how to do this. She gets undressed. She gets in the bed. She wants to please him. And they have sex.
Yeah.
And it's not great.
No.
And he's upset by that.
And then he rips her hand off.
So, okay. He does something interesting. And I found this very interesting. He tries to imitate what he thinks a guy is supposed to do during sex. Mm-hmm. Which is reach down, grab the woman, and pull her up. Because she's not responding. She's not, like, given a good performance, I guess. Like, he had mm-hmm. an idea in his head of what sex is going to be like. It's not like this. So he's like, I gotta be a sexual man. And he grabs her wrist, pulls her up, and as you said,
her hand comes off.
Her hand comes off. And he's like, oh.
Way to, like, kill the mood.
And it does kill the mood.
As it should.
It doesn't kill the woman.
It doesn't even seem to hurt the woman, really.
She doesn't bleed or anything. What does she do?
She leaves.
She gathers up her stuff. Gathers.
She does
up,
wail. She does wail.
But not like in pain. Not like, oh my God, I got injured. More like something went wrong. Or like, I don't know. Again, none of this is explained. She gathers up her stuff. She's upset, but she takes her hand from him. He's still, like, holding her hand or her forearm. Mm-hmm. He runs into the guy comes to pick her up, right?
Yeah.
And is like, hey.
So, everything go well?
How'd it go?
I think so.
Yeah. Where is it? He sits around. That's what it is. He sits there. The guy comes to pick up the money. Mm-hmm. He gives him the money. He's like, everything all right? He's like, yeah, I think so. He's like, all right, we'll meet again. Don't worry. He turned away and pressed the black time switch for the staircase light because it's a cheap place. The lights are on a timer. I did not watch him go. I was sick and freezing. And so far, despite what he said, our paths have not recrossed. The yes. end. That's it.
That's it.
The woman goes away, and that was his first sexual experience was with a woman whose body falls apart. Now, commenters on this, and this story has been commented on quite a bit, as you can probably imagine, because it's weird.
It is weird.
I mentioned that, like, any other writer would have been like, oh, she was a reanimated corpse.
I was thinking a weird mannequin person.
Or she was an automaton or a mannequin. But none of that's there's no explanation is given.
Yeah.
Is she a real person? Is she a dead person? Like, it would make sense if she was a zombie. Doesn't bleed, I guess. Like,
well,
I don't know why.
Reanimated corpses would be obvious.
They kept sticking swords into. Maybe she was a pop-up pirate.
Maybe she was a pop-up pirate.
What if a pop-up pirate had come out of her head?
That would
like
have
one
been
of the swords in it.
Ba-dang! Awesome.
And they're like, yay, you, or no, you lose, pop-up pirate. That's the only other thing I can think of where you stick swords into something repeatedly. They don't stick the swords into her all at once. It's one sword at a time.
Well, you don't stick the swords into Papa Pirate all at once.
This story is about sex.
Papa Pirate is not.
Not about sex. I mean, I'm looking at that barrel.
No. Do not ruin Papa Pirate for me.
Can you turn Papa Pirate into a fleshlight?
Stop.
I can't get it off. Well, the doctor's like,
did
you lose the plastic swords? Yes.
Anyways.
Do you know they're still selling pop-up pirates, but they're now themed? Like, there's an E.T. pop-up pirate.
I'm sure, like, those existed when pop-up pirate first was a thing.
Yeah, this is a themed pop-up pirate. Like, a bunch of them have just come out.
I'm only going to get you different pop-up pirates for holidays and birthdays now.
The E.T. one is weird because it's supposed to look like a spaceship, but mm-hmm. you stick things into it and then he pops out. And I'm like, I don't remember that part of E.T. I don't remember them sticking swords into him. pop-up pirate.
Anyways, back to Sword Lady.
This story is about sex.
Yes.
I don't know if you read into that.
I didn't need to read into it. It's fairly obvious.
I mean, there's literally sex in it. It's a lot like the expectations men are expected, like, are given mm-hmm. going into sex. Like, sex is a performance. Sex is a...
It almost is a commentary on how, on, like, toxic masculinity, in a way.
In a way. Mm-hmm.
Because it's about how the idea of men being aggressive during sex actually hurts women more than... Like, it hurts both men and women.
Yeah. Yeah. It's odd. It's such mm-hmm. an odd tale. It upset me a lot.
Yes. I did not like reading this.
Like, it's seedy and grimy and gross, mm-hmm. and then it's over. And you're just sort of left to sit in it, which I think was Aikman's point.
Yes.
And it's funny, like, when we read The Whimper of Whipped Dogs, I felt gross.
That's not his story, but yeah.
No. What I'm saying is when we read The Whimper of Whipped Dogs, I felt gross.
I felt gross by that story because it was a terrible message.
And that story made me feel gross about the author.
Yeah.
This story doesn't make me feel gross about Aikman.
No.
Because I think he was trying to make us feel bad.
Mm-hmm.
Also, it's a very strange tale.
Yeah. I think it meandered a bit. I thought some of the writing was a bit meandery and unnecessary.
Did you know that he finally ate his pot pie?
That's good. I'm glad.
He finally ate his pot pie. He talks about that pot pie. Like, he orders his pot pie and then he can't eat it. And then he's like, yeah. What am I going to do with this pot pie? So he brings it home in a takeout box. And then finally later he eats the pot pie. To me, that's the kind of thing that makes this story even weirder. Is like,
yeah, the weird details that are focused on. And, like, you know, it also makes the story feel more real.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're going through weird experiences, you latch on to the normal things. You latch on to one detail, and that's what you focus on. Like, you latch on to the sword, the description of the swords.
Because mm-hmm.
you don't want to look at any of the people because you're freaked out. You latch on to the carousel because it's the one shiny thing in a bunch of grime that you don't understand what's going on. Latch on to the pot pie because it is a stable, real thing in this nightmare land you've crossed into.
But also, it's not a nightmare land because it's just Wolverhampton. Like, it's a real place that you can go to. And, like, I've read some reviewers who are just like, oh, yeah, I've been, like, to that area. I know where he's talking about. Like,
mm-hmm.
I got stuck in that place once. Yeah, there's nothing going. It's just a boring town that this, like, fun fair showed up at, which, except for the fact that there's a woman who can get stabbed repeatedly and also falls apart when you have sex with her. It's just a shabby fun fair. Like, it's not mm-hmm. the Something Wicked This Way Comes fair.
Yeah.
It's not run by demons. It's just... Also, there's, like, a dwarf. There's, like, a man who he runs into at one point who's, like, behind it. Like, there's, like, a whole scene with
Watchmen.
This guy. Yeah.
Because
he sneaks in one night. Yeah. He sneaks in at night to kind of get a look around, like, into the tent, but the tent is all, like, closed.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And the Night Watchman's like, what are you doing here?
And he's like, I don't know. And I'm like, bro, get better at lying.
Yeah. Yeah, he's like, I was just going to, why would you, in any case, he's not a smart guy. He's just a guy. He's just some schmuck, which makes it even weirder. Like, he's a salesman and like this, he doesn't lose his job. Like, he doesn't learn anything from this, it seems. It's just, he starts off by being like, man, your first time's always the weirdest, huh?
And everyone who's listening to the story is going to be like, bro, what?
Yeah, like that. Like,
Excuse me?
I imagine him finishing, I'm like, I never saw him again. And like everyone he's talking to is just like, they're all holding drinks. They're like,
yeah.
And he's like, that's my first time. What about yours, bro? And they're like, wait, what?
Yeah.
Her hand fell? He's like, yeah, her hand fell off, man. Anyway, cost me 10 pounds.
Weird stuff only happens the first time. You know what I mean?
Yep,
no, what are you talking about?
Took me like 8 women before I got over that. Anyway... Yeah, that's what's so weird. Yeah, it's such a strange tale. The swords. Would it surprise you to learn that there is a TV adaptation of the swords?
What?
Would it surprise you to learn there is a television episode of an anthology TV series based on the swords? Not only that, it is the premiere episode
why is this story the first story in so many things?
Not only is it the first episode of a TV series,
it is also the last episode of a TV series.
It is the first episode of a TV series that ran for 2 seasons. But wait, it was also directed by Tony Scott, the director of Top Gun, Beverly Hills Cop 2, Days of Thunder, True Romance, Enemy of the State, Spy Game, Man on Fire, the late Tony Scott, brother of Ridley Scott, who we've talked about him.
We've talked about Tony Scott too.
What?
We've talked about Tony Scott too, yeah.
Yep, we talked about Tony Scott, talked about Top Gun.
We watched Top Gun.
The movie he did before Top Gun was called The Hunger. Mm-hmm. It is a movie about a vampire couple played by Catherine Deneuve and David Bowie. Also has Susan Sarandon in it. It's a very stylized, very stylish, very strange movie. There's a TV series that Tony Scott produced. Also, Ridley Scott was one of the executive producers, called The Hunger. That is inspired by the movie The Hunger, but not about the movie The Hunger. But it was basically like, we want to do TV that captures the feel of this. Like, more horror that's sexy. And so they're like, our first episode is going to be...
The Swords.
The Swords. So
how did they make... I don't...
No, here's the deal. The Hunger TV series was made for cable. Mm-hmm. Made for Showtime, I believe. Okay. 1997 to 2000. Hosted by Terrence Stamp in the first season, by David Bowie in the second season. So, like, those connections are still there. David Bowie, Terrence Stamp, first episode, The Swords, directed by Tony Scott, written by Howard A. Rodman, stars Balthazar Getty, Amanda Ryan, Timothy Spall, Scabbers the Rat himself, and Jamie Foreman. It updates the whole thing, sets it in the late 90s, completely turns the whole thing on its head. The main character is like this playboy who's sent to London to chill out. He starts getting into like the S&M scene. He has two friends who are gay and he hangs out with them. The Swords is like an S&M show. Mm-hmm. Same basic thing happens. The woman gets stabbed with swords. You see it like it's done with like early CGI, but it's pretty effective. But in this story, he gets, you know, propositioned. Do you want her? He's like, sure. But in this story, she ends up falling in love with him, right? Mm-hmm. And tells him, this guy found me, the sailor character, who's played by Jamie Foreman, found me, renamed me. She's not called Madonna in it, obviously. That'd be weird.
That would be weird.
She's like, he told me that I have a spell on me, like a force field that surrounds me. And like, the only thing that can break the spell is if people doubt the spell or question the spell or challenge the spell, something like that. They end up having a relationship, going on dates. She falls for him, but the main character is like, who narrates the whole thing is like, I don't know. I just couldn't get into her. Like, I don't like commitment. I didn't want like a relationship. So he ends up just being like, whatever. She gets more despondent. Finally, in their last sex scene, and there's like nudity and sex because it's for Showtime.
Yeah.
In the last sex, she is kind of like she is in the short story. She's just affectless. Mm-hmm. And he gets like upset and like pounds away at her. And then falls asleep. She gets up and leaves. When he checks the bed, there's blood where they had sex, which doesn't make sense because she can't get hurt. Mm-hmm. He figures out what happened, rushes to the show. But by the time he gets there, it's too late. They're doing the sword show. She gets stabbed, but this time it actually kills her.
Yeah.
And so it's like a completely different theme, mm-hmm. which is more about violence to women, like explicitly, like the violence of sex, like the dispatch. Like, it's weird. It's not great, but it's interesting. And also, it features the music from the movie True Romance, which I know you've heard because it's this like xylophone or marimba music that was really popular in the 90s. You got used in a lot of movie trailers. It's like very clink, 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 clink.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
That's used in like, so that pops up, which makes the episode also a lot more emotional because I have a lot of emotional time. It's tied in with Tony Scott because he did True Romance. The dun 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 bum 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 bum. So this is playing like through a bunch of their scenes, which made me emotional because it made me feel like there's a lot of emotion tied in with True Romance, which is also another show, a movie about like weird relationships and like the violence inherent in relationships. bizarre episode. It's on YouTube. I first only found it dubbed into like German, and I was like, I don't know what's going on. There's a lot of violence in it. Timothy Spall, Scabbers himself, he's not a salesman. He works for like a cosmetics firm. Mm-hmm. All Timothy Spall does is he's a presenter at a conference they keep cutting back to him talking about women's beauty. Doesn't have anything else to do with the plot, but it's kind of like commenting on like our attitudes toward women. Weird. It's very weird. But yes.
Montage effect.
Yeah. Very weird episode based on the swords.
How many of these short stories do you think have been turned, like in this book, have been turned into episodes of things at this point?
A lot. But I'll tell you one thing. The Hunger TV series, it's got an F. Paul Wilson story. It's got Brian Lumley, Graham Masterson, a bunch of Graham Masterson. It's got David Morrell's story. I think we've done a David Morrell story. Carl Edward Wagoner's story. It's got a ton of people who we've covered. A Harlan Ellison story. I can't believe this show isn't more well known. A Gemma Fyle story, a Kim Newman story, a Tanith Lee story, a Poppy Z. Bright story. A ton of great writers contributed their stories to this show.
I don't think we've done any D names yet.
Any what?
D names.
B names?
D names, because you mentioned David something.
Oh. Well, you know, like we've done a lot of stories.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a Charles DeLint story. We haven't done Charles DeLint, but like there's a Ramsey Campbell, two Carl Edward Wagners. I think, didn't he do Sticks?
Sticks. Yes.
Was that him? So if you can seek out, I know it's been released on DVD. If you can find The Hunger, check it out. It's a wild. I had a friend on Facebook who was like, she was like, oh, I was obsessed with this show. Because the whole theme of this show is it's all like about sex. Like every mm-hmm. episode deals with sex. So, I mean, and the cover of the DVD has like vampires on it, which is weird because it's not vampires. It's erotic horror. In any case, the swords.
Any show that deals with how weird sex is.
It's going to be weird.
Yeah.
So what do you think?
It's a great story to talk about.
You're going to read it again tonight, right?
I'm never going
to
read it.
Before you go to bed, you're going to be like, oh, I'm sleepy. I got the sleepies. I got my milk, got my cookies. Pop
I'm
open
Santa
the
Claus.
Yeah, I'm going back up the chimney. Ho, ho, ho. Stab Mrs. Claus with some swords.
Yep.
Watch her slowly come back to life. This would have been a terrible episode of Cabinet of Curiosities.
This would have been an awesome episode of Cabinet of Curiosities.
A monster shows up at the end.
She rips her arm off and she turns into like a horrifying monstrosity.
I could see Del Toro like adapting this. This would be a weird.
This would be a. This would. I had a comment I was going to make on this I had something I wanted to say that had to do with Guillermo del Toro in this story.
Was it about one-legged sex?
No. What?
Devil's Backbone.
Oh right. Yeah. No. I think that. I don't know if he'd like the story.
I don't know. Who knows what the man likes?
But I think that it. It deals with some of those themes that maybe he likes to deal with.
Yeah. The psychosexual stuff. That's mm-hmm. sort of an undercurrent in a lot of his movies. Or yeah. an overcurrent in a lot of his movies, like the sex ones.
Yeah.
Also, at the end of the story, our main character becomes a real life boy. So it's kind of a Pinocchio's.
Yeah. I mean, he did Nightmare Alley.
Yes.
This kind of felt like Nightmare Alley in a certain way.
That seedy carnival grossness.
Yeah.
Yeah, and a despicable main character.
I didn't think he was despicable. I just thought he was dumb.
Yeah, and he did pull a woman's hand off.
He did pull a woman's hand off. I felt kind of bad for him, I'm not going to lie. I felt worse for the woman and all the other women in the story. But, like, I felt like, oh, he has all of these, like, he's obviously not surrounded by a lot of great male role models. Like,
no.
Like, not at all. Like every man he interacts with in this book is kind of a nightmare. He does only interact with men though until he interacts with this woman.
I'm just gonna come around and say it. If you're having sex with someone and part of their body falls off,
stop having sex with them.
Stop sex and like I don't know, offer to help something.
Yeah, like
call
like,
someone.
Oh, shoot, maybe we shouldn't call an ambulance because that's expensive as hell. But yep. I'll take you to the hospital.
Any body part, even if it's just an ear.
Mm-hmm.
Stop what you're doing. Offer to take him to the hospital. Or at least say, like, is this supposed to happen? And if they're like, sorry.
Yeah. Also, if the person you're having sex with isn't responding and seems, like, not interested, check in with them.
I was just going to say, check in with them.
Yeah.
That's probably sex rule number one.
open communication.
Do a lot of checking in. This boy, not too good with communication.
No.
Yeah. Also, don't lose your virginity to a person you saw get stabbed a bunch of times with swords who was then sold to you maybe against her will at a diner.
Yeah.
Probably just not going to be a great first experience.
It's still Toro time sex education.
Yes, that's our sex ed segment. Yep. And seed.
And seed, yep.
What is our next story?
The roaches.
The Medusa and the Shield, Dark Descent, the roaches.
I'm not looking forward to this.
Why not?
I hate bugs.
If there's one thing I know about you, it's that you love a bug. Yes, The Roaches by Thomas M. Dish? I never knew how to say his name. I'll figure it out before we talk about it.
It says that this should be compared to Stephen King's Carrie.
Well, much like in Stephen King's Carrie, we'll be dealing with a lot of bugses.
Oh, so, but there's some absurd humor in this piece, apparently.
I cannot wait. And it's Dishian charm. Diskian charm, Dishian charm.
Just a few steps short of parody.
That's what they tell us. So that's what we're covering next time. The Roaches, check us out. We're still on Twitter at Del Toro Time.
We're
check
on Twitter us on Facebook. For as long as it exists.
Seems to have stalled out. We're until on we Facebook.
Until we get banned for doing an episode that insults Elon Musk.
Right. Which I guess maybe it's coming. Maybe
we're going to cover the Glass Onion.
We're going to cover the Glass Onion. A good movie, by the way.
Great movie.
Glass Onion. That's our, yeah. I don't feel like Rian Johnson needs our help.
No.
To be successful. No. My favorite thing about Rian Johnson is that he had a $1.333 billion Star Wars movie, but people still treat him like he's some kind of like working class underdog. Yep. Like, people will insult one of his movies online. Fine. Whatever. I like the Glass Onion movie. I like Knives Out. People will come to his aid and his rescue like he's a poor kicked around boy. He's a white guy who made a Star Wars movie. I don't think Rian Johnson's ever going to need anyone's help ever again.
Yeah.
Some of the people of color who are in his movies, yes, come to their aid. They need your help because mm-hmm. people gang up on them. Rian Johnson, he's around Charlie Brown face boy. He looks like a lollipop of a man. He seems nice. I'm not saying he's not nice. He seems like an ice cream pop of a person. He's like very good filmmaker.
He's from the Lollipop Guild.
He's a Lollipop Guildman. People come running up. They're like, oh, our poor, poor boy. The man has a net worth of $100 and some million. He's doing okay. He gets to make movies with all the celebrities he wants. He's doing okay.
And he does really good with it.
He does really well with it. He's a good filmmaker.
And obviously, so do all of the people who work on those movies. Because they deserve credit as well.
They do. But you don't need to spend your energy coming to the aid of Rian Johnson anymore. He's doing okay. He's doing okay.
Yeah.
Hope he makes another Knives Out movie.
They have the green light for the third installment of it, so.
Let's do it. Let's go for it. And we're going to do another episode of this show called The Roaches. So until we never even said who we were.
We didn't do an intro for this episode.
We didn't. So now for the intro's outro, I am Phil.
And I'm Willow.
And we'll see you when it's Del Toro time.